Welcome to this webinar from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a business marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. And it's run by business marketers for business marketers. We provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, podcasts, training, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. And today we have over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. And check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. Today's webinar is open to questions. So as you listen, type a question or comment into the questions box, and I'll put those questions and comments after we've heard from our speaker. Please also flag in the questions box if you'd like to be a speaker at a BMC webinar, write about this one, or find out more about the BMC, and I'll be in touch. You can tweet along to today's webinar using the hashtag BMCValue. That's BMCValue. The slides for today's webinar will be shared again in our podcast newsletter that goes out every Friday. And there's a white paper too, which is available to all members of the Business Marketing Club. Our speaker today is Emeritus Professor at Cranfield School of Management, Malcolm McDonald. And he's here to talk about how to develop financially quantified value propositions that capture the attention of their customers. Malcolm is formerly Marketing and Sales Director of Canada Dry and now a professor at six of the UK's top business schools and chairman of four companies. Professor McDonald, welcome to the webinar. Thanks so much for coming on board. And let me hand over to you now. Thank you.
First of all, why do we need financially quantified value propositions in the first place? Some definitions and examples and some process steps. And can we move the next slide, please? Right, just some initial thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, value is what the customer needs, not what you want to sell them. Now, most of us in our lives, in our commercial lives, know what I mean by this. And we've all fallen into the mistake of trying to flog what we want to flog them, as opposed to understanding real customer needs. The second bullet point says profit in inverted commas is the byproduct of doing something customers value. Now you'll notice the inverted commas under profit, and that's because profit is a bit like a sausage, isn't it? It's very tasty until you find out what goes into it. I just wanted to make that point. And then the third bullet is don't ask customers stupid questions about what they want.
Check where it was, it's not there, so you have to get numbers.
Is everything all right here? Can you hear me?
So we can hear you. I think, Louise, you're also on sound, so you might want to go on mute.
Okay. Anyway, the third bullet point is don't ask customers stupid questions about what they want, because nobody has ever known what they want and nobody ever will know what they want, which is why a great big chunk of market research is wasted money. I mean, nobody asked Apple to invent iPads and iPods and iPhones and music downloads. They just made life more interesting and exciting for us. And let me give you a silly example of which I've just made up. Imagine the 19th century before the cars were invented, and there's a horse and carriage, and I stop the horse and carriage with four people in it, and I say to the first person, what would you like? And of course they say, well, that's very kind of you to ask, Malcolm. Could you go away and invent the internal combustion engine for us? And I say, what's the internal combustion engine? And they say, well, it's the associated corpuscular emissions per 0.0 gram of air, producing ions carrying one electricity of either side. I say, thank you very much, that's brilliant, I'll go away and invent that. I say to the next one, what do you want? And they say, well, this horse stinks. Could you go away and invent air conditioning? Good idea. The third one says, what about windscreen wipers? Good idea. The fourth one says, what about ABS brakes? I know it's a stupid example, but you know exactly what I mean. Customers have never known what they want, and it is a not the way to go about developing financially quantified value propositions. So can we move to the next slide, please? Okay, next slide. What we've got here is it's exactly 24 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, I started a research club at Cranfield sponsored by IBM and companies like 3M and Siemens. And it was called the Key Account Management Best Practice Research Club. And it's still going strong today in 2020. But over the years, I've always been careful to invite a number of buying directors along so that we get the other side of the coin. And every buying director I've ever invited over the past almost quarter of a century has used a matrix a bit like this, where the vertical axis talks about attractiveness, low and high. What that basically means is differentiation, low and high. And the horizontal axis, we buy a little, we buy a lot. And let me refer you to the top right box. The point is that over the years, I've discovered from the buying community that only about 1% of suppliers are sufficiently different to warrant asking and getting their customers to pay a premium of between 15 and 25%. That's 1%. That figure is staggering. Now, what that means, if you look at the bottom right-hand box, is that most organizations, pimply little me toos, where the customer can buy it anywhere, and you'll never guess what they do, they buy on price, and I don't blame them in the slightest. So can we move to the next slide, please? And this I also borrowed from a buying director. And if you say something like 50% of costs are outside purchases, if you can get that down, can we go back to that slide, please? If we can get that down by 6%, guess where that 6% goes? Straight into the bottom line. And I don't blame companies who behave like this, however much we might hate it, when it goes straight into the bottom line and they're buying stuff they can buy anywhere. So can we move on, please? And this is a simple slide. All it's saying is proving the point that price has always had the biggest impact on the bottom line, followed in second place by costs, and in a poor third place by sales. So if you've got a price of £10 and your margin is a wonderful £2 and you sell 100, for a mere 5% discount, you've got to sell a third more. And for a 10% discount, you've got to sell twice as many. So why would anybody ever even dream of trading on price? So can we move to the next slide, please? And I know this is not strictly true, and I say price is only ever an issue in the absence of quantified value. I'm talking here about organizations who truly understand the concept of value, as opposed to those organizations who will never understand the concept of value. But the point is, it's the supplier's job to quantify the value, not that of the buying organization. So moving on, please. I got this funny fetish about websites. I must confess, I spend quite a bit of time looking at websites, and the majority of the ones I look at, ladies and gentlemen, are truly pathetic. I mean, I've just looked, if you look at this one, you know, we've got better quality, great reputation, good results, we're very responsive, blah, blah, blah. Even business schools, university business schools are the same. They all witter on about themselves, saying we're triple A accredited, and nobody gives a toss about you and what you do. All they care about, customers, are themselves. And I learned the hard way myself. About 6-7 years ago, I looked at my own website and discovered it was about me. It wasn't about the customer. So I changed it, I hope for the good, and talked about all the issues in terms of customer problems, and then what I might be able to do for them. So let's move on, please, and look at the case for financially quantified value propositions. I've already said during my introductory comments that only 5% of companies have got them. My statistics show it's about 2% of companies. You've got the slides, or you will have the slides. Can we just look at the bottom three bullet points on here? The research shows that you close more deals, typically up to 10%, that the sales cycle will be reduced by up to 25%, and it'll help reduce discounting by between 10 and 30%. So I'm going to give you an example of this in a moment for you to look at. If you look at the next slide, there are one or two other benefits that we've got here. In particular, the bottom one, sustained relationships. It used to be called, and still is, customer retention. But very few companies measure customer retention. What they measure new sales. What they don't measure and report to the board is customers they've lost. And yet, unless Harvard Business Review and Bain and Company and Forrester and the like are wrong, losing 5% fewer customers each year can lead to an increase in profits of about 75%. So why don't we do this? And the point I'm making is that this is linked quite directly to financially quantified value propositions. So let me give you a quick example of this, ladies and gentlemen, on the next slide. It's called sales velocity. And you can see the equation. I don't want to linger on it now because of the time element, but you've got the number of leads times the closure rate times the average deal size divided by the sales cycle. And you know, the example I've given on the next slide, I've used on the next slide, please. What I've used on the next slide is a quick example. And it shows that just using the minimum of those statistics, and there's a reference for those statistics, incidentally, on the previous slide, you can see an increase of 34% in sales. And I'm reminded when I see slides like this and equations like this of the cartoon I saw 2 or 3 years ago of the marketing director in front of the board. And he was saying something along the following lines. Yes, it's a pity that our profitability is down by 50%, but the good news is our Facebook likes are up by 40%. And the point I'm making is that nobody gives a toss about that kind of thing. What the directors are interested in is the pipeline, the sales pipeline, and what we're doing in the marketing community to accelerate that, which is where the financially quantified value propositions come in. So moving on, please, from here, and you can have a look at these slides, of course, later. Don't worry, I'm not going to go through all of this. This is a slide provided by my colleague, Grant Oliver, who's a buying director for the National Health Service, which is one of the biggest organizations in the world. And if you look at the bottom right, you'll see that total time frame for a sale is between 4 months and half a year. Now, given the statistics I've just talked about, could you imagine the increase in profitability if you could get that sales cycle down by producing financially quantified value propositions? So let's move on from there, please. Just some definitions and examples, moving on. The word value, of course, has been, if you'll excuse the pun, devalued quite a lot, because supermarkets and things like that, when they talk about value, what they mean is we've dropped the price and it's a cheap and nasty product. We, in our community, know that value means something totally different. But I'm not talking here about Porter's value chain, which I'm going to refer to later. I'm not talking about accounting value. I've discovered about 15 different definitions of net profit in the accounting community. I'm not talking about Rappaport 1986 economic value added, now known as shareholder value added. And one day, if Dave is listening to this, I'll give you a talk on this, because it is the arbiter of success in society, in business society, whether we like it or not. Then you get brand and customer equity. These are financial terms. And until recently, I was chairman of a company called Brand Finance, and we used to put a financial value on the brands of companies like Shell and so on and so forth. What I'm wanting to talk about is this, the bottom bullet point, value propositions. And if you look at Investopedia, it says a business statement that summarizes why a customer should buy a product or service by adding more value or better solving a problem. And then the two bullet points I put in blue, customer value. It's the customer's perception of value, not ours. It's highly personal. It's often referred to as value in use. And it varies quite significantly by customer and by segment. And I'm going to talk about that later. And then we get value co-creation, something that most organizations, I'm sad to say, are not very good at. Can we move to the next slide, please? And organizational value co-creation, very little research being done on this. But if you take, for example, legal firms, they're very poor at this. What customers want, what clients want today is an organization to get its act together and everybody in the organization to create value for them, as opposed to just itsy-bitsy stuff that lawyers do. And so the legal profession is one that's going to have to work very hard in the future on organizational value co-creation. But this is something that business-to-business organizations haven't been too bad at, particularly organizations like 3M and organizations like General Electric. And I'll talk about some of these later on. Okay, so my definition, next slide, of financially quantified value proposition, a very simple, straightforward one. It's the translation of the supplier's offers into monetary terms and the demonstration of their contribution to the customer's profitability. And what I'd like to do is give you, in the next slide, an example of this. Now, if you think about this particular example, SKF, we all know that SKF make bearing assemblies and ball bearings. We're talking here, ladies and gentlemen, about bits of steel. It's not exactly the height of sexiness. It's not very attractive, is it? But if you look at this, what SKF are able to do is to charge a premium of 50% over the going rate in the market, purely and simply by adding value. And over the life of the bearing or the bearing assembly, there is an increase in profitability to the purchaser of $30 and 25 cents. And they've got massive databases to prove all of this. And it's what enables companies like SKF and 3M to be so successful and profitable. Can we move to the next slide, please? Which I'm going to gloss over this, because this is just to set your minds at rest. And I write about it in a bit more detail in the white paper. It's just to show that a small company, in this case, a label company to food manufacturers, it works just as well. The process works just as well as in small organizations. And this company, providing something as bog standard as labels to food manufacturers, were able to show by a financial quantification tailored to each customer, all of those bullet points on there. And their competitors can't touch them. Their customers love them because it's removed an element of pain from them, and they're better off as well. So it applies to small companies as well. Okay, can we move on, please? This is what I asked. I haven't got time to ask it today, and I'm not sure we've got the technology anyway. But when I've got these big audiences and the audience response system, so you get honest answers, I ask them, having explained what a value proposition is in detail, I say our value proposition for relevant customers are financially quantified, justified, and proven. Score your organization on a scale of 1 to 10 against this statement, with 10 being perfect. And that's where I get my statistics from. And again, it makes me feel very sad as a marketing professor that my community doesn't seem to understand the crucial importance of doing value propositions properly. Okay, let's move to the process itself. Next slide, please. And the slide after that. You'll see we've got six steps that I was promising to talk about. Sorry we were delayed, ladies and gentlemen. But you've got define the target market. You've got identify buyers. You've got added value analysis. You've got the financial quantification. You've got categorization. And finally, you've got communicate it to the target customers. Now, to do this successfully, ladies and gentlemen, requires a lot of hard work, and it requires quite a lot of business acumen as well. So let's start with the first one. That's the next slide, please. Define target market. And the next slide. This is a slide for those who turned up at my session about a month ago. I referred to it then as the 80-20 rule, the Lorenz curve, whatever you want to call it, a Pareto's law. We all know how it works. And this is just a simple process of listing along the top your products or your product groups, and along the vertical axis your markets. And so in the case of Canada Dry, we had hundreds and hundreds of products, but fundamentally there were only about five or six product groups that were crucially important. And along the left we had things like supermarkets, airlines, hotels, pubs, and so on and so forth. And what you will always find, and it is inevitable, and if I were running an in-company workshop, this would be the first piece of work we do, you will find always that 20% of your products, products for market, account for about 80% of your sales. And we hope, if you do it properly, for your profits as well. The reason for saying this is that quite clearly, the last thing in the world you want to be doing is wasting your time doing value propositions for everything that moves. Just pick the most important 20%, and then the top ones of the 20% to make a start, and then I'll show you how to prepare value propositions for them. So moving on from there, please. Step two is identifying the buyers. Now, I call this market mapping, and it's a bit more complicated than just the two bullet points there, end users and partners and distributors. But I've got a market map here to show you. And do have the next one. Do have a look at this one when you get time. This is for capital equipment in the medical market in a particular country. And when I showed this to the board of directors, it's amazing the effect it had, because it was the first time anybody really understood how the market worked. And if you look at the technician's box towards the bottom right, one of the problems this company had was that its sales force were technicians, for fairly obvious reasons. Now, being technicians, what they tended to do was focus on technicians in the market because they were good at that. But you can see just a brief glance shows that there were other major buying groups and administrators and final users who were responsible for placing orders. So the first thing we have to do in the quantification of financial value propositions is to understand how the market works and who buys. And can we move to the next slide, please? Next slide is what we know in our community as a perceptual map. This is a map of buyers of IT. You'll see here nine segments. And the point I want to make is that we as suppliers never ever have, and we never will sell anything to an organization. We sell it to people in organizations, and people in organizations don't stop being human beings with emotions and different needs. And this is what I was saying earlier on during my preamble, saying don't ask people stupid questions. You really have to understand what the Save My Budget person is interested in as a buyer, the business general, the conservative technocrat, the radical architect. They're all different. They all require different value propositions. Now, there's no way you would prepare a value proposition for all nine segments. What you would do is you would choose the two, three, possibly four segments that you really want to be successful in, and you would profile these people and you would develop value propositions for them. So next slide, please. That's perfect, that one. This is what's happened, ladies and gentlemen, over the past 50, 60 years. I'm going to talk about the purple blob at the top right from now on. I'm going to talk about key accounts, major, major customers. Now, a key account, as you know, it's a customer that you treat as if it was a market in its own right. They have become increasingly important over the years with their own processes, their own systems. And of course, they frequently account for a substantial part of our sales. So I'm going to focus from now on, ladies and gentlemen, on key accounts and how you develop value propositions for them. So next slide, please. I want to get into the difficult bit, the added value analysis. And the next slide. This is an untidy looking slide, and I don't want to spend too long on each one of these, the macro environment, the sector micro environment, and the company. I'll spend a bit longer on the company. The only point I want to make, if we can move to the next slide, is whether you call it pest, steep, or whatever it is you call it, we all know, as we're sitting here today, how radically this has changed because of the COVID-19 situation. So we need to get in there and find out what is happening and how it is affecting our clients and our customers. Moving on from there, we get to the sector. Now, everybody will know, particularly those who've done MSCs and MBAs and things like that, Michael Porter's Five Forces. It is a brilliant way of analyzing a sector. It's not the only way, but it is a brilliant way. I usually use it with my clients. And again, things have changed quite dramatically over the past 3 months, 4 months. And we need to understand what's happening to our competitors and the sector so that we can decide what to do. Can we now move to the next slide? And we're going to start talking now about the individual company. Now, if you look at this is just a smattering of things that I want to talk about. I won't talk about everything, but one of the things that I've always found very useful is an organization's annual report. It's quite useful in the things that it spells out, like major achievements, problems, issues, objectives, strategies, and so on and so forth. I mean, recently I went to Washington, D.C. to run a session for the main board of a company that makes mega multi-billion dollar power stations. I looked at their annual report and I learned so much from that annual report. And I was much more helpful when I went to talk to the board about their strategy. And the next slide, please. And please, I don't want you to any of you to commit suicide when you see this slide, but you all know that this is at the top of every company, all your customers. It's the top of their agenda at the moment. Financial analysis. It's all changed for obvious reasons. And we need to be on their side. We need to, if we can't find out this information, we need to get alongside their accountants or accounting people to find out in what ways all of these things have changed, like their current ratio, their net profit margin, their return on assets, collection period, stock turnover, because we're there to help them. Okay, and the next slide, please. Now, this is the last model I'm going to show you. It's Porter's value chain. Again, many of you will have seen this from courses you've attended. And again, I find it, Michael Porter from Harvard, a brilliant, brilliant academic and practitioner, changed the world with his work. But if you can look at an organization in terms of its inbound logistics operations, outbound logistics, marketing and sales, and after sales service, and its headquarters support activities, it is amazing, once you understand how a company works, how you can help them. So next slide, please. This is just a expanding on it very, very slightly, showing what some of the items under inbound logistics and operations and so on and so forth. And here's an example. Next slide. An example. I know it's a crowded slide, But do please, those who have taken the trouble to log on and listen to me, do take, please take the trouble to look at this in some detail. This is a software supplier to a manufacturer. And you'll see when you look at the detail, how they were able to offer advantage to the customer on all of those items. And you can see how, although it's just software, and the software that they could get from more or less anywhere, it's nothing to do with the product. All products today, ladies and gentlemen, are excellent. We know that. So you're not going to get any real advantage from having a product. Most products are the same. They all work. They're all the same pretty well. The way you get advantage today is by the way you relate to your customers and your markets. And you'll see that they were able, this organization, to uncover all kinds of ways in which they could add value and create value for their customers. So do please have a look at that in the peace and quiet of your own study. Can we move on, please? Now we get to the difficult bit, financial quantification. Next slide, please. So we're now ready to complete the financial quantification of your value proposition. Now, I've got two worksheets which follow, and they summarize all the previous analysis in financial terms. And I just want to make the point very quickly that if you're not absolutely certain of the financial value of every element, estimate them as they can be refined later in discussion with the customer. And just a thought, something we all remember, it's better to be approximately right than precisely wrong. So the next slide, this very, very busy slide, you will not find a slide like this anywhere in the world. This is a slide that has resulted from all the work I've done with different organizations around the world on financially quantified value propositions. And you'll see it says worksheet 6. That indicates, for obvious reasons, why I've missed the first 5 worksheets out, because I've only got, in theory, 50 minutes to do what I normally do with a company in 2 days. So if you look at the vertical axis, you'll see from the steep or pest analysis, from Porter's 5 forces analysis, from the annual report summary, from the financial analysis, and from whatever else you've been able to get information from the customer or the client. Then we go along the top and we say, describe the opportunities or threats to the customer. What's the opportunity for us, if any? How important are these possibilities for the customer and the client? And then we get the 4 really important boxes. Added value is the main one, because this is how you help them increase sales and those kinds of things. And you'll find in the white paper, I've given you quite a comprehensive list of what added value means. You've got second heading is cost reduction. The 3rd one is cost avoidance. And the last one is intangible benefits, which I don't have time to cover today with you, but there are undoubtedly the intangible benefits, which are harder to quantify, but nevertheless, they are there. And if you cast your eye to the box at the bottom, you've got total dollars, euros, and pounds, and you're bringing it all together. And the next slide, please, is a summary of Porter's value chain. And it's a similar kind of process. You'll see the inbound logistics operations, et cetera, at headquarters. The value chain, you've got finance, procurement, technology, and so on and so forth. And then along the top, you've got customer weaknesses. You've got the opportunity for us, the supplier. You've got the importance or impact to the customer. And again, you've got those 4 headings, added value, cost reduction, cost avoidance, and intangible benefits, and the box at the bottom. Now, I've made this sound possibly a bit glib. The kind of analysis that leads to filling these 2 forms out requires an enormous amount of business nous, business training, understanding tools and techniques. It requires a lot more than a typical salesperson has got. And that's why the whole sales domain is changing quite dramatically. Because of the kind of sophistication that we're looking for to offer customers. And again, you won't find anything like this anywhere else in the world. So I'm almost finished, Dave, so don't worry. Can we go to the next slide, please? Now, and the next one, we're going to categorize these, because what we've done, we've got lots and lots of fantastic information, and you know, you can't just dump it on the customer. And clearly some of the benefits of your offers will have a greater impact than others. So given the urgency and the limited time to present to your customer, this will be a very important part of the total process. And the following worksheet on the next slide, I've developed this over the years, and again, you won't find anything like this anywhere else. You'll see the words in the top left box, creating advantage. Most of the things we do in business help your customer avoid disadvantage. So creating advantage for the customer is something totally different. I mean, most things that we sell, I mean, you've got to have laptops, you've got to have desks and things like that. They don't create advantage, and you can buy that sort of stuff from anywhere. So a big part of this complicated analysis that I've been talking about is how do we create advantage for the customer? And only some of the things you're able to offer them will create advantage. And some of them are strategic, some are high potential, some are key operational, some are support. And if you look at the key, strategic are issues that will ensure the customer's long-term success. High potential are issues that, whilst not crucial currently, could potentially lead to differential advantage. Key operational are issues that, unless solved reasonably quickly, could lead to a disadvantage for the customer. And finally, support are issues that, whilst of a non-urgent nature, such as information availability, nonetheless need to be solved to avoid disadvantage for the customer. Now, if I might just refer to this COVID-19 situation that we all find ourselves in, I suspect here that many of your customers and clients are going to be more interested in key operational and support issues in the short term. But I want to stress that we really must keep focusing on the strategic and the high potential and the creating advantage box as well. So that's just a comment about what's likely to happen over the next few months. So can we now move to the next one, which is communicating it to target markets? And moving on to the next slide. Again, please don't stab yourself in the eye with a fork by looking at this slide. I've used this slide since 1967. That's how old I am, ladies and gentlemen. Look at the date at the bottom. It's a fantastic piece of work. It describes the buying process down the left and the kind of things they're interested in at the bottom, along the bottom, and then the kinds of individuals and departments who are involved. Now, I explained this to my clients, and I was with one client in Australia, a business-to-business major organization, and they were a bit depressed because they had just failed to win a contract with one of the biggest car manufacturers in the world. And I talked them through this, and I said, why don't you go away and retrospectively analyze this particular client, going through the phases and so on and so forth. It took them about 3 hours to do it, and the chief executive made them complete it. And then the sales director stood on the stage, having done all of this, and he announced to the whole conference, the whole organization, he said, ladies and gentlemen, he said, we've done this analysis, and he said, we succeeded in getting only 15% of the right information to the right people at the right time. So this isn't the only diagnostic tool you can use, but quite clearly, we need to tailor the value propositions that we've developed to the right people at the right time. Right, this is my next slide, please. This is my penultimate slide. This is something that I've developed with my colleague from the National Health Service. He is truly amazed, ladies and gentlemen, when he gets people, teams of people from organizations in front of him, and they're bidding, they're talking about multi-million pound projects, and he has the gall to say to them, can you please tell me what the return on investment is? Can you please tell me what the payback period is? Can you tell me what the internal rate of return is? And many of these people who are presenting these proposals look at him as if he's just landed from the planet Mars. Now, this is a way, a shortcut, it's a dashboard of bringing it all together. And I just want to assure you that when you've done all the hard work, if you can get it into this kind of format at a presentation, if the finance director is there, even the finance director will understand it and they will love you to death. And the chances are you'll get the order. So last slide, please. You don't need to do this now. It's a value proposition self-assessment for you and your organization. It's self-explanatory. It will tell you how good you are at it. And then we get the final slide, please, the very final slide. What I've done, I've given you my email address, and that's the important bit, because if there is anybody over the past 50 minutes that I failed to insult, my apologies. If you send me an email, I'll send you a personal insult, I promise you. And if we can't cover all the questions during this short period we have remaining, please feel free, ladies and gentlemen, to send me an email, and I promise you I will deal with it. I will reply with it to the best of my ability. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, about the slight technical problems we had at the beginning, but we managed to struggle through the slides. Can I just remind you, you've got a copy of the slides. You've got a white paper that puts all the detail and plus a lot more around financially quantified value propositions. And there is a step-by-step process in there as well. So please enjoy it. And can I now hand over, please, to Dave or Louise and say, do you want to me to ask any? If there's any questions I can't answer, Dave, I'm going to ask you to answer them.
I'll be very careful what I ask in that case. We've got time for one or two questions if people want to ping them over. I think we've got one that I can ask in just a minute. I did want to be clear. We've had a few comments about access to the slides. So just in terms of how to get hold of these things. So firstly, this webinar is being recorded and you'll be able to hear it back from tomorrow. And you'll be able to hear that at the in the usual place on our Business Marketing Club podcast stream. Then in terms of the slides, we'll be sharing the slides again in our newsletters that come out on Fridays and on Tuesdays. So there'll be two opportunities for everybody to be able to access those. And we'll also, for members, share the white paper at that time too. So hopefully everybody who wants to be able to access the materials will quickly be able to do so.
Can I just say, Dave, in the white paper, there is some quite fantastic material in there, and the slides, although it was only intended for 50 minutes, I'm a professor, and I believe the role of a professor is to profess. So I'm not one of those that puts my arms around everything and says you can't have them. I would like people to use the slides, share the slides, and promulgate them in any way, shape, or form that they want. So that's what I believe marketing education should be all about. So I just want to make that point.
Well, that's a great point, and we concur, and you know, we're very, very keen to be able to get this great content out there. We've got some questions, Professor. So first of all, here's a question from Karen Birch. Karen asks, how long does the entire process take, and how difficult is it to get the relevant information from clients? So I'll ask that question again. How long does the entire process take, and how difficult is it to get the relevant information from clients?
Well, it is a question really. I mean, what one shouldn't do is try and do it for the whole organization. What we should be doing is eventually we should be doing it for a strategic business unit, an SBU. We should be doing it for a market. We should be doing it for a segment. We should be doing it for a product, and we should be eventually doing it for major customers. Now, if you set about the process ab initio, you'd get in a right mess, and you know, you wouldn't be able to do it. So the way I get people on this journey is I always say, why don't you take one of your major customers and get a small team together and work hard at producing. Let's say you've got a customer like IBM or somebody like that. Let's take IBM as an example. And we're going to put a financially quantified value proposition together for them, no matter what we're selling them, whatever it is. And if you go through that process, you will find that once you start looking, for example, at the macro environment, I mean, that information is readily available, Dave. If you look at, again, Porter's Five Forces, in the main, about a sector, you know, that is generally readily available information. Because we're blessed today. I mean, when I was marketing and sales director of Canada Dry, we weren't blessed with this fantastic array of information that you can get today. So you've got to know how to use the internet to get this information. When it gets to the client, Dave, or the customer, my experience is that there's so much information, again, available on the internet about organizations. I mean, I used to run a program about, it was called Competitive Intelligence at Cranfield. And I used to get these chief execs there. And I used to say to them, look, I can guarantee I can tell you five things about your organization that you should know that you don't know. And you go to the internet and you find these five things. And when you tell them, their mouths drop open because they should know them, but they don't. And I can tell you, you know, then you've also got the actual client themselves. And my experience is that if you've got a reasonable relationship with clients and you know you're trying to help them and you've done some groundwork already, as opposed to going in, you know, sort of gobsmacked and saying, I don't know what I'm doing, can you please give me all this information? You're asking for specific information, and it's there to help them. And my experience is that most organizations are sufficiently friendly and cooperative to pass useful information over. Having said that, Dave, and I just want to make this point, I do quite a lot of work for the European Institute of Purchasing in Geneva. And there, when you get all these buying directors there, I can tell you the bad news is that about 50% of all organizations out there, and I'm sure this will resonate with many of the people who are listening to me at the moment, about 50% of the organizations out there, their buying directors are targeted and rewarded and remunerated on getting prices down. And so trying to create financially quantified value propositions for people like them, I'm not saying it's a waste of time, but you've got to be very, very careful that you select the right targets in the first place. Otherwise, you end up wasting a lot of time. So that's the bad news. The good news is that 50% of organizations out there do understand the concept of value. And the world's worst, incidentally, Dave, the person who asked the question, the world's worst are governments around the world, particularly our government. Every time our government puts something out to tender, a bid, we always choose the worst, the lowest price, and you get the least value, and it costs us billions and taxpayer billions of pounds because the numpties don't understand the concept of value. I wish I could get an audience of ministers with me, you know, one day to talk.
There are no ministers listening in. I'm sorry for that. Professor, do we have time? Are you okay if we ask two more questions?
I'm very happy. My Nigerian Chardonnay is going a bit warm, but I don't mind.
Okay, this question comes from, and I'm hoping I'm saying your name right, Nada Khosravani. And Nada says, brilliant presentation, thank you. To what extent does the process and rigor applied change if you're creating new products as a startup in a category that's just forming and very opaque? So to what extent does the process and the rigor that you need to apply change if you're talking about creating new products as a startup in a category that's just forming and very opaque?
Yeah, I can see, Dave, that you've got members who are determined not to ask easy questions. The point is, I mean, if you look at you know, how organizations like Apple and Amazon and all those organizations, I mean, how do they bring new products to market? They've got a deep understanding of the way people behave, and they are able to understand where the gaps are, and they fill those gaps with fantastic products. And all I want to say is that, you know, you go back to the basics of marketing. You've got to have a deep understanding of how any market works. You've got to segment that market into groups of customers who share the same or similar needs. You've then got to understand the needs of those segments. And in doing that process, you will uncover, I promise you, you will uncover gaps in the market. And then we've got to fill that gap. That's what our role is, filling the gap. That's what all successful companies do. I mean, it's what 3M do, for example. You know, they're well known around the world for their innovation and creativity. And they go through this process with their customers and their clients. And they always, always, companies, again, like Rolls-Royce, they always find new ways of doing things and filling gaps in the market. But the, you know, the process, if you're talking about how you launch new products, that's a different seminar entirely. But the process, as far as I'm aware, and I've worked with a number of companies on this, as far as I'm aware, I don't really see much difference in the process. I mean, the process is going to vary by sector. It's going to vary by by market. It's going to vary by country. But in the main, the process works. It's robust. It's been tried and tested and proven. And when I go to an organization, what I always do is try and understand what their problems and issues are, what the peculiarities are, then apply the process. And the process works step by step. It works absolutely perfectly, I promise you.
Cool. And so one final question in that case from Maria Cameron. And Maria asks, to what extent are new disruptive models changing the way that we approach value propositions? So think Uber or Just Eat. So to what extent are new disruptive models changing the way that we approach value propositions?
Well, you see, this, I think, is a great big myth, this whole argument about disruption. The only reason anybody is allowed to disrupt anybody is because of the lazy, complacent organizations that sit there not paying attention to their customers' needs. And, you know, the world is full of organizations who sit there thinking it's going to go on forever with their legacy systems and their legacy cultures and their legacy capital investments. And they sit there. And what they've, I mean, this is the whole problem with marketing in 2020, because we're fannying around with things like the internet and, you know, digital and social media, we've forgotten to get a grip of what's happening in the market. And so in most organizations, who is looking after the market and the customer in the boardroom? Don't tell me it's the finance director, because all those guys are doing is what I talked about last time, which is anorexia industrialosa. An excessive desire to be leaner and fitter, leading to emaciation and eventually death. That's not a strategy. Somebody needs to take charge of the market and the customers. And that means a deep understanding of the market, market mapping, how it works, segmentation, understanding the needs of the segments, developing value propositions for them. And the only reason somebody is allowed to disrupt something is because companies don't do that. Marketers have got to step up to the plate, David. They've really got to step up to the plate and get themselves back in the boardroom where they belong, because we're too busy fannying around with things that are not really the concern of marketing. So I'm a great believer in marketing education. I'm a great believer in marketing in the boardroom. Although I'm a bit of an old git now, I'm spending my life, even at my age when I should be well and truly retired and enjoying my Nigerian Chardonnay, I can tell you I'm spending most of my life promoting the concept of marketing and the role of marketing and giving people tools and techniques for doing these things. So it's lazy organizations who lose sight of the needs of their customers and their markets. They're ripe to be, they're just waiting to be disrupted. Somebody will come along, an entrepreneur, and then you say, disruption. And the answer is, hang on, the solution that they're offering is better than the crap that they're, you know, that customers have got used to. So there's going to be more and more disruption and less organizations step up to the plate and do proper professional marketing. Sorry to get on.
I think that wake-up call is a good one on which to end and help you get to your Nigerian Chardonnay as quickly as possible. So let me say thank you to Professor Malcolm McDonald. And as I said, Malcolm's slides will be shared again in our podcast newsletter that goes out on Fridays and on Tuesdays. And there's the white paper too, which is available to all members of the BMC. Thank you to Malcolm, and thanks to our brilliant backroom team of Louise Neal, Claire Sheriff, Josh Bench, and Jay Neal. And thank you to everyone for participating today. Next Wednesday at 16:30, our COVID-19 webinar returns with the Chief Marketing Officer of Capita, Antonia Wade, the Commercial Marketing Manager at McAfee, Edel Welsh, the Partner at the Magnus Club, Teresa Allen, and Marketing Director at Really B2B, Gemma Rolfe. As I said, you can listen again to this webinar from tomorrow, or you can listen to our weekly podcast. This week, the subject is great client and agency relationships. Or you can get yourself a mentor to help you at this time. Or there's the next F2F training session with the legendary e-marketer Dave Chaffee, and that's on Monday at 12:30. Or our next networking event, the Business Marketing Big Community Hall, which is on the 8th of July at 4:30. Details of all of that, plus where to find Malcolm's materials, can be found at businessmarketingclub.org.uk, and you can contact me as well at davestevensnow@gmail.com. That's all for now. I'd like to, on behalf of Malcolm, Louise, myself, just say thanks for listening in and stay safe. Thank you very much.